Hi, folks. My name's Brooks Bell, and I'm an alcoholic and a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I've not had a drink of whiskey all day today. And the steps and the traditions and surely God's grace has let me fulfill the only requirement for membership in Alcoholics Anonymous that I'm aware of, the desire to stop drinking, in my case, the desire to stop dying since October 17, 1973. And I am truly thankful for that. God, don't applaud me, applaud God. I guarantee you I haven't had anything to do with it. The slight persistent effort on a daily basis, you know, that's about it. I would like to welcome our first speaker, Johnny, from the West Indies.
To the chairman, presenters at the head table of this international meeting, my AA family, my AA friends and their spouses, Al-Anon members, and guests, a special good afternoon. My name is Johnny, and I'm sure that I'm an alcoholic. Sober, but for the grace of God, for 22 years, 8 months, and 12 days today. I don't want to bring greetings by myself, but I have some friends from Trinidad. May you all stand? So I'll say we bring greetings from Trinidad and Tobago, a twin island paradise in the West Indies. It is an honor and privilege to share for the first time in an international forum. The topic today is on willingness, an essential of growth. It is by no coincidence that the daily reflection meditation for today deals with WHO. And it said that they are the essential of recovery, but these are indispensable. But I must let you know that I made my first AA meeting on the blessed night of 20th October 1987, during which a switch was flicked on in my head and streaks of reality came to light. I did not sleep that night. I was now willing to go again. Primarily, this readiness or willingness is today responsible, firstly, for my life and my growth in Alcoholics Anonymous. With this ongoing readiness, I continue to attend AA meetings every night possible. I joined a small home group, and a rush of enthusiasm to serve came. The dictionary meaning of the word willing is to be ready. At this point in time, I was becoming a happy recovering alcoholic. My true escape required a willingness to follow whatever right actions and principles necessary, which kept me free in a kind of extended daily probation. In my willingness to surrender, the light came on brighter. I was told to acquire a sponsor to guide me through the 12-step program of recovery. I was somewhat reluctant to do this, as I didn't trust anyone to that extent as yet. The only real obstacle on my path to possibility will always be myself. Then this wise AA member made a coherent statement which circumvented this fear. He said, if I went for a vacation in another country, I'll be given a tour guide whom I did not know. And I will have to trust him with my life. This enlightenment caused me to find a sponsor who subsequently guided me, creating a sequence of transformation within my life. He informed me that the benefits are in the willingness to carry out the actions and not to get immediate results. You must do in order to be. My willingness to embark on the recovery process and to surrender to my sponsor saved me from a lot of fear and anxiety. As my fears were gradually diminishing, God was now taking his rightful place. I was becoming a little patient and my pace slowed down. My depression was gradually being replaced with an expression of love, and my loneliness was now physically filled with lots of caring and loving friends. The willingness to grow is the essence of all spiritual development. This catalyst called willingness helped me to connect with my higher power, something I was now persistently searching for. And one morning, early, around 5:30 a.m., while brisk walking and praying, I had a sudden spiritual experience. A connection was made. The good Lord can mold you into anything you want to be, but you have to be willing to place everything in his hands. At this point, things started to happen in a sort of wonderful way, which fueled a further willingness to continue the process. The willingness to surrender my pride and self-will to a power greater than myself has proved to be the essential ingredient necessary to solve all my problems. Even the smallest amount of willingness, once sincere, is sufficient to allow God to enter and take control over any problem. My level of spiritual growth is in direct relation to my willingness. A true revelation of my independence came from my willingness to depend upon a higher power. As my willingness grows, my trust increases, and so is my dependence on God. I heard from an audio piece that the definition of willingness is a readiness to do what my sponsor says to do, even though I don't want to. As my sponsor and sponsee relationship got more intensified, he had asked me to do some internal investigations. There I made certain discoveries that I was pleased, displeased, and alarmed about. The analysis of certain emotions and behaviors allowed me, for the first time, to understand myself more in depth. These revelations sparked the willingness for further investigation, where some underlying morbid cysts of the past were hidden, for which a separate report was done secretly. This part of the report was not meant for my sponsor's ears, and a grave wave of willingness for the action of confession had to be mustered. Then, confession was done secretly at an old Roman Catholic church located at a mountainside far from home. When I left the cubicle with the aged priest, I experienced the meaning of the word levitate. I became aware that most of my faults came from my need to feel secure and loved. This forgiveness gradually translated into moderate compassion and deliverance into a new realm. All it takes is a willingness to forgive, and God will do the rest. Confession is an ancient way of freeing the soul, and truly adheres to the saying that less luggage make sorrow more comfortable. My sponsor saw the willingness in my actions and hinted that it was preparation time to address some of my faults. I had to determine if I was truly ready to let go. Firstly, I must say his patience and tolerance with my smoking made me decide to quit. This presented a huge challenge beyond my control. This, I must say, lasted for months. It was my willingness to entirely give it up that I discovered one night what was sincerity in prayer. The next morning, I didn't have the urge to smoke. This wonderful experience made me not only to believe, but to come to know the presence of a loving God. No adversity, difficulty, or doubt can have any power over you unless you allow it. Letting go was easier now, and restoration was slowly evident. I rallied some time feeling really good about myself. Too often, I do not see things as they are. I see things as I am. Then my sponsor declared that there are significant areas that I still have to work on. At this time, I was becoming very comfortable here. Two important rules of the path are to begin and to continue. There is a saying, if you don't, God won't. Willingness, a master key to open all doors, again made me ransack my memories for persons I offended. On completion of this listing, which later of course had additions, brought me to a point where I can see clearly a significant amount of growth in all aspects of my life. Seeds of willingness were sown, and they are harvest now. There was to be a greater understanding of humility concerning direct confrontation of the ones that I harmed most. A great man once said that the most rewarding things you do in life are often the ones that look like they cannot be done. Here is where my willingness subjected me to the test. The final puncture. Oh, what an experience, which as a result highlighted the profoundness and efficacy of these principles of recovery. In a discourse, an explanation of the ego was simplified. Shah Jahan, the great king of India who constructed the Taj Mahal, went to a mosque. On arriving in his chariot, he left his robe hanging outside the church door. A great lesson is learned. To use your ego as a shirt and not as your skin. Know when to wear it and when to take it off. This sponsor, I must say, was relentless in my recovery, and in so doing, we developed a mutual symbiotic interdependency. He said he inherited from me an enthusiasm that he later shared was as a direct result of my obedience and willingness. No wonder the word willingness appears 36 times in the big book Roman numerals. He was now talking evaluation, that accurate self-appraisal, the honest and careful handling of everyday situations that gave me tremendous satisfaction and joy for the changes that God has brought in my life through my willingness. That stimulus for growth. At this level of my development, my motives are always carefully analyzed. Communication in every sense is of great significance. It is here that a brand new wonderful realization comes with a further development of a true friendship with Him Most High. It is here in quietness that my willingness helped to expand my vision, and I entered a new horizon to discover new ways of doing old things, to change my perspective and line of thoughts. I understand faith as being sure of what I hope for and certain of what I do not see. In a sermon, a priest spoke of vertical and horizontal communication. Vertical is with my God, and horizontal is with my fellow men. It is evidently clear that a transformation has taken place. Sobriety now fills the painful crater of my soul. It is said that when there is a light in your heart, it is reflected on your face. This way of life is living in the moment and enjoying it to the hilt. And in order to live a life of grace beyond gravity, you have to have two things. First, you have to have a strong desire to live your best life. And secondly, the willingness to live it each day. As the day begins, I bow and say, "Thank you, Father, for this day." And I now report for duty. My higher power presents many opportunities for deeper spiritual awakenings. The most wasted of all days is one without laughter. I must be reminded that ingratitude is worse than the cobra's venom. The willingness to help selflessly and for the right reason is now known. The poet Khalil Gibran wrote, quote, "Work is love made visible," unquote. You should learn to love your work. Service to humanity eventually becomes service to God. You will get tremendous joy from working for God, and you will become tireless. As I close, I would like to say that God carries us into deep waters not to drown us, but to save us. Every living thing has a place in the natural order of things with a destiny to fulfill. So, do all the good you can, by all the means you can, in all the places you can, at all times you can, to all people you can, as long as you can. I thank you. I thank you. God's blessing them.
Johnny and I are going to have a foot race for that hat after the meeting. He might win. I don't know. We have imported from Canada the rose amongst all these thorns up here on this dais. Nancy W., and I'm anxious to hear her share. Come on up, Nancy.
Stop that. I am an alcoholic. My group is Ancaster 12 and 12. My name's Nancy. What an honor and a privilege to be here. I want to thank San Antonio for showing us this party and for your outrageous hospitality and volunteerism. Unbelievable. Unbelievable. My friends were on the sidewalk the other night, and they were just looking at a map, and there were like two volunteers right there. There was some gravitational pull to like help them out. Where do you need to go? This is my fourth international convention, and every convention, my friend John and I make up these AAA pins, and I'm loving to see them everywhere. I am blessed and honored to be here. This morning on the bus, I met a young man who's 41 days sober, and his name is Nelson. And I asked him about willingness. The poor kid got dragged out of bed too early, he said. He's 41 days sober, has been to two campouts and an international conference, and he's looking a little overwhelmed. So if you are here, I want you to keep the willingness and the enthusiasm that you showed on the bus this morning. When I think about willingness, I think of what I was willing to put up with when I was drinking. I used to drink and drive a lot. It was a terrifying, nasty habit. A little while ago, I was driving in Toronto, and there was something wrong with my eye contact, and I had to drive, you know, like this for a while, and I thought, oh, I haven't done that in a long time. You know? But I would lose the car. I hated losing the car. My car was full of these drunk bumps, you know. I checked the grill of the car more times than I care to admit, and I was just, I knew how much harm I could bring. I knew how dangerous I was, but it was just, I in a blackout, I was drinking and driving all the time. One time at the university I went to, I had partied at this place and came out in the parking lot the next morning, and I found my car in the parking lot. Only this time, there was something hanging underneath the car. My friend was with me, and he had not seen it, but I had, and I could not draw attention to it. And he's given me grief, and he can't believe I've been drinking and driving again, and he's telling me to go to the cafe and meet him for lunch, you know, and I cannot get in this car. But, you know, because I have an ability to hide and to be able to walk through a very emotionally charged situation calmly, I got in that car and I pulled out, dragging whatever it was underneath. I came around the edge of the campus, and this man in a parking kiosk stops me and says, I've got something hanging underneath the car. And so I finally look under, and what it was a huge clump of landscaping grass. I took out a chunk of campus, I don't know what, but, you know. And my alcohol logic immediately let me think, oh, blow these things out of proportion. But the truth was that I knew how much damage I could bring. I knew how dangerous I was. And the knowledge of what I was capable of and where I went and what I did to keep drinking and with whom I did that gave me emotional scars that terrified me, because I saw what I was capable of doing. And because I felt so broken, I needed to be hidden. And I was willing to do anything to keep hidden. I couldn't possibly show you how bad I felt. When I came into Alcoholics Anonymous and I heard people say that they thought they were bad, like, I knew that I was toxic, that there was something inherently broken in me, and the only thing that I could bring it home to was that I do not possess the ability to love or be loved. You know, I just wasn't born that way. My last drink was on August 28th, 1993. On that night, it was my birthday. I was turning 29 years old. This guy was with me. We were sort of on a date. We were drinking at my place, and we went out to dinner to have a lot of, and we had a lot of wine to drink. And then we came back to my place to drink some more before we were going to hit the bars for last call to drink. And because, you know, that's a date. And when, before we hit last call, or, but when, after dinner, when we were back at my place, he was really drunk. He was really drunk, and he was really loaded, and he started throwing up off my back deck. And all I remember thinking was, is that, man, if this guy keeps throwing up, I'm gonna miss last call. Right? And that was gonna be a problem. And he did go home, and I didn't make it to the bars that night, and, when I woke up, the next morning, I was 29. And I don't know, my moment of truth, my moment of clarity, my bottom was just being tired. I was tired. I saw my life clearly at 39 and 49 and 59, and nothing was changing. I knew that I did not have the willingness to live this life on my own terms, and I needed you. And I came in because I knew, I saw that I could not stay sober another day. And I came in to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I became willing. I became willing because I was in pain, you know, and taking my hand off the hot stove, it's easy to be willing to do that. But I eventually led myself into a group that gave me the steps and a strong foundation in service. Service saved my life. Service absolutely saved my life. And because I was willing to give of myself, you were able to restore me to be happily and usefully whole. I had an ability to, in the third step, I said every day the third step prayer, and that key of willingness. You know, my sponsor uses the word fuel when she talks of willingness, and that makes sense to me. You know, it's the gas in my tank that gets me where I need to go. The third step, it's the key in the door, and just open it a ways to be willing. You know, what I do not want is a theoretical willingness. You know, I mean, when it talks about the fourth step in the 12 and 12, it says this is your first tangible piece of willingness to move forward. And I needed to do that. I was so frightened to do my fourth because, you know, there's a fifth after you have to do. And that was really what kept me hidden. And that terrified me. The fifth absolutely terrified me. But when it says in the 12 and 12 that until we are able to talk about those things which have kept us hidden for so long, our willingness to clean house remains largely theoretical. And I don't want theoretical willingness. You know, willingness needs to be almost synonymous with action, and this is a program of action. And I was led to believe, the theory saved my life, that this is practical. It's practical. You know, God is a verb. It's not a noun. I don't think my way into good action. I act my way into good thinking. And so I started to do the steps, and I did the steps, and I did the did the fifth. And, you know, in the sixth step, there is very good reason why this separates the men from the boys. I have willingness to have the sixth step. I rested on my laurels and paid dearly for that because I stayed in pain. A lot of my character defects, even something as innocuous as procrastination, which is basically a conscious decision to live in pain, it kept me sick and grounded. I believe that we will choose the certainty of pain over the pain of uncertainty, you know, because what might life be like if everything really is okay? And I get this happy and normal and successful life that I say I want. But I have a very nasty habit of sabotaging my success, you know, and I needed to become willing to let normal come into my life. And one might think that's an easy thing, but you know, the big book says the alcoholic life is the only normal one we know. And man, I tell you, if the phone's not ringing with some creditor or my mail is not registered, I don't feel alive, right? You know, and I needed to, you know, now I find my very normal life wildly exciting. But then I was just, you know, I was addicted to action. I was addicted to the chaotic and unmanageable life in all threads of my being. I had the eighth step, you know, with willingness, became willing to make amends to them all. It's that all that, you know, I have repaired and restored a large portion of my life. And it was that last one that was most difficult. And I don't even know if she thought that amends was necessary, but I did, which is the most, you know, important thing. And I'm so grateful for the powerful process of amends making and how it restores and heals us. You know, in step 9, where the promises come, if there's anyone new, I need to remind you that on page 83, we have promises here. And that is what they are. These are not things that normally happen or could possibly happen. You know, I promise you, you will be amazed before you are halfway through. You will know a new life and a new freedom. You will not regret the past nor wish to shut the door on it. My personal favorite, you know, becoming willing to what my last drunk, I it wasn't, as I say, the last the worst thing that ever happened to me. I was just tired. And I believe the old timers when they talk about a bottom being a state of mind, you know, I did not get put in the back of a police cruiser. I did not get assaulted. I did not have my mother crying. I did not break furniture. I did not break a window. I did not have friends mad. I didn't owe any money. It was all of which had happened before. It wasn't the worst thing that ever happened to me. But I was tired. And that powerlessness and that defeat led me to become willing. But after about my fifth and sixth year of sobriety, the willingness can have this, complacency can come in, and that is critically dangerous. And it is combating that complacency that where service saved my life, because you're just not allowed to be very complacent in service. I don't know about the service in your area, but I mean, we are burrs under the saddle and thorns in our side, and that's basically our management structure in service in Alcoholics Anonymous. That's how we work. I have a life today that I shouldn't have, you know. I have a husband and two boys. We have a dog and a hamster. I have this normal life. I suppose God wants us to be happy, joyous, and free, but to me that translates into being sane and useful. You know, being useful gives me purpose. It helps me be of service. It helps me direct my life and to be willing to do His will, to be being able to do it, to do what I think He wants me to do. I need to tell you that my whole life I felt fraudulent. When I was drinking, I was so terrified by my actions and where I went and what I did that I needed to be kept hidden. And so I went to any lengths to stay that way. And what Alcoholics Anonymous did for me, and especially the third step, is that although I still felt fraudulent when I came in here, the third step put me in a state of neutrality. I wasn't fraudulent, but I was far from authentic. And eventually, the 12 steps led me to a place where I am comfortable in my skin. I feel like I am on the path that I should be on. And as I trudge this road, I know that I have a purpose and I am authentic. And for someone who has led her life in fear and fraudulence, which is the core of the pain for me, you know, when Bill Wilson says we're very much the actor, I needed to wear that mask. And for someone who has always felt fraudulent her whole life, there is nothing sweeter than the gift of authenticity. My husband he's not in the program. He's a civilian. But he's nice anyway. He's very nice anyway. And he is home with our two boys. My Eric is 10 and my Scott is 9, and they're up at our cottage and they're fishing and out on the boat. I am a mother and a daughter and a sister and a friend and a neighbor and a worker. And I am all of these things because of you. And I am not missing the gene to love or to be loved. You know, willingness and working the steps in Alcoholics Anonymous taught me how to do that, because that is a very practical process too. And I cannot thank you for that. I cannot thank you enough for that. If Alcoholics Anonymous gave me a bill at the end of the day, how could I? I could never repay it, you know. I need you to know that although Alcoholics Anonymous just interrupted my death, what I think you ultimately did is give me a process to lead me to be the authentic self and to be of service and give me that purpose. I have this sober fridge at home. I don't know about you, but part of my wildly exciting normal life is looking in my fridge. Because when I was drinking, my fridge was disgusting. I had I always had a broken beer bottle in the freezer that I never cleaned up because it broke from the night before. And I had, you know, fuzzy things in margarine containers in the back. And I had this, you know, ugly, greasy mayonnaise jars. And, you know, now at home, I get to open my fridge and it's very colorful. It's colorful, and I've got fruits and vegetables, and I just love my sober fridge. I love my sober fridge. I love my life. I love my children, for whom I don't know what I would not be willing to do. And I love this happy, sober motherhood life that I lead. My son Eric, I was putting to bed. This is a while ago, and he was. We were feeding his favorite beloved monkey, his stuffed monkey, blueberries, because that's his favorite food. And my husband came in to say goodnight to Eric too. And Eric says to his dad, "Mom and I were feeding monkey blueberries." And my husband says, "Aw, Eric, your mama loves you so much." And he said, "Yeah, and I sure love my monkey." So that's about right. And my Scott, who is very stubborn and bright, and I snapped at him one day, and I needed to make amends and say I'm sorry because he didn't deserve it. And all day he was like, you know, "Remember when you were wrong, you know? God, and you, because you made me cry and you had to say you were sorry. Remember when you were wrong?" And I'm like, "Oh, yeah, I remember. Not that well yet, you know." Oh. But I tell you, when I am driving in the car and we're going to the swimming and the dog is in the back and I'm wondering what I'm pulling out of the freezer for dinner, I get this grateful on my knees overwhelming feeling because I shouldn't have that. Shouldn't have it. You know, that's not where my life was headed. That's not where I was going. Everything in my life did not, I should not have the life that I do, and you have given it to me. And I am so blessed to be a part of Alcoholics Anonymous. We are AA. We are the future of Alcoholics Anonymous. We have a message to carry and the privilege and willingness to share it. Lives are saved here. And from the very bottom of my heart, I thank you for saving mine. Thank you.
Well done. Our main speaker, Tom, we imported at vast and great expense from California. He told me right before the meeting, said, "All I have to do is look nice and not swear." And I said, "Those are the qualifications, my boy. Come up here and tell us about willingness."
Easy, Eric. I'm an alcoholic. My name's Tom Navarez. And my sobriety date is January 3rd of 1989. And my home group is the We Group of Alcoholics Anonymous in San Diego, California. And we meet at 6:30 on Monday night and 7:30 on Thursday night. If you're ever in San Diego, please come and see us. This is pretty heavy, man. This is a big room. And it's really cool. My sponsor is here, and I love him very much. My sobriety brothers are here. I love them very much. My friends are here. I love you very much. I'd like to thank Gail, who is our DCM in our area, and she threw my name in a hat and it got drawn. That's why I'm here. And This is my third international. And, you know, I was talking to somebody before I left, and they said, what are you looking forward to most? They knew I was going to talk, and, you know, is that it, or what is it? You know, spending time with your sponsor? No. And, you know, my experience at these things is to just come with as a blank slate and be open to whatever. You know, when we were in Toronto 5 years ago, I had no desire to go to the Eastern Bloc countries meeting, but I went to support a friend of mine, Ski, because he was talking there. And that was one of the best AA meetings I've ever been to in my life. And so what do I know? You know, it's cool to be open to a new experience and to embrace that, whatever it is. So I invite you to do that this weekend. Don't have an agenda. Just be open to a new experience. So before January 3rd of 1989, my life was pretty much defending a lie. And the lie was that I can have one beer. And that's still the biggest lie in my life. And today the biggest truth in my life is that I'm powerless over alcohol. And that's why I'm here. You know, it's amazing. I've been thinking a little bit about having to talk here over the last couple months. And I think about how willing I was to the things to defend the lie that I could have one beer. All the people that I hurt, all the money that I wasted, all the property damaged and everything else. I mean, I was really willing to do that. You know, I was willing to go to jail. I was willing to watch my mom cry hysterically over and over and over again. I was willing to hurt wives, girlfriends, kids, to drink. And then, you know, we come into AA and then want us to get commitments. It's like, what? Make coffee? I don't think so. Until I get to that place, you know. So I started drinking really young. And I was talking to a friend of mine a couple of years ago, and she's in the medical profession. I never thought of it like this, but she was talking about allergies. And she said, you know, when you're exposed to something you're allergic to, the reaction is always worse the next time. And how true that is for us. You know, I would give away another chunk of truth and another chunk of truth and another chunk of truth in my life to be able to drink and live that lie. And, you know, people offered me help and I didn't want it. You know, it's amazing. We're going to have, 60,000 people here this weekend. And there's people that are going to be a block away that are going to die in the street from alcoholism. And I can relate to that. I started coming into AA meetings after I, to not go to prison. I got 3 DUIs in 11 months. And the judge was really pissed. I bounced in and out of AA for 5 years, and in that 5 years I could never get 30 days sober. And I would typically come into AA, that thing needs a new wheel. I would typically come into AA on Monday mornings with a hellacious hangover, spent the rent, you know, out in the morning looking on the front of my truck for hair and blood. And, you know, maybe I need to go to a meeting. And sometimes I would stay sober all day. Sometimes I would stay sober for a couple weeks. And, you know, but I could never get 30 days in that 5 years. And there were times where I really wanted to stay sober, and I couldn't. So, there's a big difference. You know, our third tradition talks about the only requirement for membership is the desire to stop drinking. It's definitely not the only requirement for recovery. And I have to continue to be willing to do those things, you know, that I wasn't willing to do. Example, in that 5 years that I was coming in and out, there was a week where I really wanted to get sober. And I went to a meeting on a Monday, and it was at an Alano club, and they were talking about a potluck they were going to have on Friday night. And I said, you know, I'm really going to try. I'm really going to jump into this thing with both feet and really try to be a part of this thing. So I brought the only thing I knew how to cook at that time was a pot of beans to this potluck. And everybody loved my beans. They were all gone at the end of the night. And I had heard people talking about sponsors and the steps and all this stuff. And I really didn't know what it was. And I finally got up courage enough after the meeting to ask this guy to be my sponsor. And what I heard him say was that I was going to have to perform oral sex on him every day for the rest of my life if I wanted to stay sober. And I said no. And two nights later, I was laying on the floor of the Silver Spigot because I'd fallen off my bar stool. And the barmaid standing there with her arms folded, shaking her head at me. She goes, "You need to go back to AA." I said, "I was just there, and this guy told me I wasn't ready." And I know today what he asked me is if I was willing to go to any lengths. That's not what I heard, but that's what he said. And I've been sober for 21 years and haven't had to do that yet, so don't be scared if you're new. Maybe that's one of the yets for me, I don't know. So, January 3rd is my sobriety day, and my last run started on Christmas Eve of 1988, and it was a hell of a run. And by then, the party had been over for a long time. I mean, me partying looks pretty gross. You know, I'm by myself. I have blood underneath my fingernails from picking at myself. I'm hallucinating. I stink. I've run everybody out of my life by choice. And I got to a point where, you know, I heard Clint Hodges tell this story in my first month of sobriety. And, you know, when I party like that, and I don't sleep because I do other stuff, and I'm laying in bed, and I'm frozen laying in my bed, not because I'm tired, because I didn't want this huge rat in the corner to jump on me and attack me. And as the sun came up, I saw that the rat was really a pair of socks rolled up in the corner. And I had gotten to a point where, you know, all of those Mondays that I would go into AA meetings, I would feel guilty about not seeing the kid, about being a bad worker, about not showing up for work, about spending the rent. I would have all this shame about all these things that I had done, you know. And I got up, and I didn't have any of that. You know, I had accepted the fact that alcohol was my master. That's just how I am, and that's how I'm going to die, and that's the way it is. And it's okay. I had always fought that. And the fight was over. I'd surrendered to alcohol. And I heard myself say that down inside. I'm like, what do you mean you don't care? Of course you care. And I knelt down in this little sunny spot in my kitchen and asked God for help again. And I called a friend of mine who'd been sober for about 6 months. He's been my best friend since we were 13. And he had 6 months sober, and he took off work and came over and spent the day with me. And, you know, he didn't know anything about Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, he was sober 6 months. But what he gave me was the most precious gift that any of us can give each other. He gave me his time, you know, and that saved my life. It's only been 10 minutes. It seems like about 25. Tender moment ruined there. He, self. He saved my life. He saved my life because he knew that his life depended on helping somebody else. And, you know, I try to keep things pretty simple because I really don't have any choice. But I like to think of a spiritual life as living in the truth. Because when I'm living a lie, it sure is not spiritual. I know when I'm doing something wrong. I know when I'm hurting somebody else. I know when my sharp tongue hurts somebody. I know it the second it happens. And I know how I feel, and I know what happens to other people in my life when I try to lighten their load, no matter what it is. And I used to equate spiritual action to belonging to a church or praying or meditating or whatever, which, you know, spiritual action for me is contributing to me living in the truth. And that's things like shaking hands at the door. That's things like making coffee. That's things like putting chairs away. That's things like being willing to sponsor people. Like being willing to be sponsored. So, you know, it's funny because in 21 years, my sobriety has been cyclical. And if I'm really honest about it, I could stand here and say all kinds of stuff. I know what to say, you know. I know what to say to sound good. But it doesn't help anybody. You know, I remember sitting in a crowd when I was new, and I would hear people say, I did this and this and this, and my life is perfect, and I don't have any problems anymore. And I'd sit there and go, wow, what's wrong with me? I try to do that stuff, and I don't feel like that. But when I tell the truth, and when I become vulnerable, when I'm willing to become vulnerable and tell on myself, it never fails that it invites somebody else to be vulnerable and make them not feel like a freak. You know, I love that about us. I love that about us, that our warts are our greatest asset, you know, and our recovery from that stuff. It's awesome. It's awesome. You know, our Rose was talking about the difference between the men and the boys. And I had a grand sponsor who used to talk about the difference between the men and the boys is living with what's left. After God removes whatever he's going to remove. Living with what's left is tough, you know. And so I truly believe that by putting chairs away and making coffee and taking all the commitments that we do in meetings, the spiritual action that we take here in AA, that my life will change, you know, and those things will go away in God's time, and they'll get better in God's time. So, it's really an honor to be here. It's really an honor to be here and hear our other speakers this morning. It was really an honor to wake up in a room sober with a couple other sober guys, and we bumble around here and be open to a new experience. You know, I think that's all I got, man, but I love you and thank you very much.
There's not enough people in here for me to speak on humility. Or do I have enough time? But I'll speak just for a second or two on willingness as I see it, as it has been expressed in my life for me. I've always wondered about God's will. You know, what is God's will for me? Or how willing am I am to accept God's will? Let me tell you something. My soulmate, Val, of 35 years, passed away last September. She was sober a year longer than I am and never let me forget it. But as she her death was imminent, and I finally was smart enough to recognize it, I have a little chair that I sit in at my house. And I was sitting in my chair and I started to say, "Thy will be done." And I said, "Thy will be done." And I said it out loud for, it might have been 20 seconds, it might have been 20 minutes. I don't have any idea. But the willingness to do that, and what happened to me, is it a sense of peace and comfort and ease came over me that I recognized it was going to be okay. I recognized I didn't have to like it. But when you look at it and you say, "Thy will be done," my experience is you pretty well better believe it. And you pretty well better mean it. And she was dead within less than a week. But I feel truly that God's will for me is to love and to trust Him. And if they're interested, tell other folks how I've gone about doing that. And that's really what I feel what... Willingness to me is to be different. Willingness to me is to say, you know, when I look at the literature and it says, "Do you now believe, or are you willing to believe that there is a power greater than yourself?" I guarantee you, in a room like this with all these drunks in here, there better be a power greater than we are. We're in deep trouble somewhere. And the reason I'm willing to change and the reason I'm willing to be different is because as I see it and I understand it, the man I was will drink again each and every time. And I don't care how long we're in here. I don't care how many days, years, or decades we got. I am one think away from a drink, one drink away from a drunk, one drunk away from dying. And I believe that with all my heart. Because the man I was would drink again. And I've got to be willing to change. You know, you and I, blessed with the gift of sobriety. You know, the only reason I feel that I am sober today is for the little fella or the little gal that walks in one of our doors that doesn't know there's an answer. For the little fella, the little gal that's dying of this disease or this illness. For the little fella, the little gal that doesn't know there is a way out. That's the only reason I'm here. As we close this meeting, I would like for you to think. I've got one little fella. It's in the drunk farm right now as we speak. I hope God, oh, I hope he hadn't escaped. I'm not even going to mention his name, but boy, I hope he hadn't escaped. But think about the folks like that.